You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Hello, everyone. I have the pleasure of having Jaeger Russell from Fairchild International speaking today about the criminal justice, specifically looking at the case of Interpol and the abuses of Interpol red notices. Jaeger, let's start with, what is this all about?
Okay, so I mean, Interpol, in most people's minds, this kind of great international crime-fighting tool, you know, fast and furious, chasing down the bad guys. The reality is quite different. Interpol doesn't have this global police force at all. It's about connecting police forces across the globe. Its mission is to connecting the world's police for a safer world. And really, it's all about exchanging information. And one of the key things it does is it exchanges information globally across its 190 member countries on people that are wanted for arrest and extradition. So they're red notices, normally called red notices, sometimes called diffusions. But they're basically a digital version of the old Wild West wanted poster. There are lots of them around. There are 120,000 in circulation globally at the moment, and there are about 11,000 new ones issued last year. So that's the context that we're working in. Obviously, connecting police forces to fight complex cross-border crime is important. The problem is that it's being abused, and countries' oppressive regimes across the globe are abusing this system to export persecution. To chase down or undermine the reputations of human rights defenders, journalists, political opponents. So that's really the core of what we're trying to tackle. We're not trying to undermine the effectiveness of Interpol. We're trying to make Interpol stronger by insulating it against abuse by countries across the globe. Basically, think of any country that, on a domestic scale, abuses criminal justice systems to silence dissent or to crack down on opposition. That country is probably also misusing Interpol. So Interpol's its way of chasing people down that have managed to escape the country. So, you know, it's a problem which has a global impact, affecting people that have fled persecution in many different countries around the world. So that's at the core of this project we've been running for about 2 years, for just over 6 months, with support from the Eurasia Programme and Open Society. And our aim, our hope, is that by the end of next year, we will have persuaded Interpol to fix the system so that it can weed out abusive cases, and so that people that find themselves on the wrong end of an abusive global wanted person alert have an effective, fair, transparent mechanism to try and get it deleted.
So what you're basically working with is that you're trying to counter the internationalization, if you wish, of domestic abuse of criminal systems for political gains. Can you give us examples of what those persecutions look like?
Sure. I mean, we've seen cases from all over the world. A case we've worked on in the past few months is a case of somebody called Baha Kim Jong-Gur, who is a Belgian citizen, and who's been working to highlight human rights abuses in Turkey. He was involved in a peaceful demonstration in the European Parliament where the Turkish foreign minister came along and was trying to tell the European Union how brilliant Turkey's human rights record now is. Baha stood up and shouted what a load of rubbish in, you know, more or less maybe slightly more colourful terms than that. But anyway, Turkey didn't like it, and Turkey managed to get red notices against him. They said that this was evidence that he was a member of a terrorist organisation, and a red notice was issued. And the result of that for Baha, pretty severe. He was arrested in three different countries, arrested in the Netherlands, arrested in Italy, arrested in Spain. He was imprisoned for 6 months of his life. One occasion he was arrested visiting a church with his two young kids and wife. Counter-terror police descended on him in Spain. They thought he was a terrorist because of the red notice. Every country, all three countries that arrested him, went through extradition proceedings, looked at the evidence, And they all said that there was no criminality involved at all, that it was politically motivated, and that all Bahar had done was exercised his free speech. And despite that, it took years to get the red notice removed. We finally managed to get it removed, but only after this guy had spent 6 months in prison. And there are cases like that. I mean, there are numerous cases like that. There's a case of Petr Silaev, a Russian case, young guy involved in the Khimki Forest demonstrations. Basically, a number of journalists that had tried to highlight corruption in the context of building a motorway through this protected area just outside Moscow were beaten by fascists supported by the Russian government. And one of them was beaten so severely that he died. So Petr and his friends organised a protest on this to protest against this in Khimki. His friends were... It was a relatively peaceful process protest. One public building was damaged a bit, nothing serious. Basically, everyone involved was rounded up by the police. Petr managed to escape, managed to get to Finland, was given asylum, was recognised as a refugee, but yet again, Interpol managed to circulate a red notice against him. And Petr was arrested in Spain and went through extradition proceedings in Spain. There are lots and lots of these cases. We've been contacted by over 100 people in the past year since publishing our report, Strengthening Respect for Human Rights, Strengthening Interpol. And really, they're all types of cases from all over the world. I'd be happy to talk to you about as many cases as you like, but really, there are a huge number, and a lot of them are journalists and human rights defenders and political opponents of oppressive regimes.
So how does it work? Why is that it's possible to publish those abusive notices, and why is that the police, despite the fact that, for example, let's say Spain, as you said, in the case of Bahad, have found that the extradition request was arbitrary. Why is it he was arrested again and again, despite the fact that one of the police organizations within Europe have found that it was a politically motivated notice?
Well, one of the things we're arguing is that Interpol should introduce rules to stop red notices where somebody has been given asylum, but also that they should remove red notices where somebody's extradition has been refused because the courts determined that it was politically motivated. We've actually succeeded in getting the first reform already, so Interpol has just introduced in the past month or so reforms to protect refugees, and we're still battling for the extradition reform. I mean, the underlying problem is that Interpol is a members club, and its members are police forces in 190 countries. And you speak to Interpol about this problem, and I mean, they're waking up to it now, but when we first started these conversations, their approach was, you know, we just have to trust their members. What we'll do is we're in the process of doing active data protection training to police forces in Russia and Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, countries across the globe. You know, we're doing this data protection training, we just then have to assume to trust that the members won't abuse the system. I mean, really, it's pretty naive, and that's how this problem arose. And they're starting to wake up to it because these cases damage Interpol's reputation. It's hugely politically embarrassing when somebody picks up at a border crossing or refuses entry to somebody who is a human rights activist or a journalist because of an Interpol red notice. So there is now pressure on Interpol to try and fix the problem. They seem very willing to do so, but at core, it's a policing organisation. And it's the police policing the police. And so really the only way to get them to do that properly is through external pressure. There's no oversight. You know, there's no democratic accountability for Interpol. No democratic accountability at all, other than the 190 police forces around the world. And there's no legal accountability either. It operates in a legal black hole. It has legal immunity. You can't take any case against Interpol in any court in the world, because Interpol has immunity in all the countries where it has a presence. So, you know, you combine this naive, misplaced trust in your member countries like Uzbekistan with the lack of any democratic or legal oversight, now you're going to get problems. And, you know, sure enough, there are problems.
So what are you proposing how to fix this problem? Because although this problem exists, Interpol fulfills a really important function of fighting international crime. And as the crime goes global, and a solution to those issues also need to become more global, we have a number of people who effectively become casualties of the system. How do you institute that change in the members club that is not democratically accountable or judicially accountable to anyone?
Yeah, as a human rights campaigner, you have to come up with kind of novel ways of doing it because, you know, your normal tactics of strategic litigation and kind of building up a democratic movement, you know, those things just frankly don't work because it's not answerable to democratically elected parliaments or to courts. So you have to come up with new tactics. And the tactic we have is making sure that we explain why this is in Interpol's interest. You know, we publicise the cases of abuse to show the problems that are happening, and then alongside that we have constructive conversations with Interpol to explain why fixing the system to stop those abuses happening is in Interpol's own interest. And they've been really open in engaging with us. We've had a huge amount of access, which I was not expecting when we started this work. I thought it would be such a closed institution that we would not get any ins at all, but we've had lots. I've had meetings with both of the two heads of Interpol that there have been in the past few years, and there seems to be a real willingness to tackle the problem, because it does no good for its James Bond image when it's found, you know, being complicit in chasing down a human rights activist. And so really it's been a combination of two things. It's public advocacy and campaign, so that's media work, basically getting those stories out there into the press where we can and through social media. And also a kind of political advocacy element, so trying to make sure that the European Parliament, the Council of Europe, US Congress, that this problem is being raised in a political context, all really to focus Interpol's mind on the problem. And the second tactic has been to come up with realistic, constructive proposals in consultation with Interpol. So we produced a big report on it just over a year ago. And, you know, Interpol were great. They reviewed the report with us. They looked through it and they said, this is workable. This kind of reform idea isn't workable for the following reason. So combining public advocacy with reasonable, sensible conversations with Interpol is the tactic.
Mm-hmm. And which arguments did they listen to? What worked for them? Because I try to imagine you go into a police department effectively and you say, let's institute internal controls because this is good for your image. That kind of works, but doesn't really go well with people who would say, well, when you're making an omelet, you have to break some eggs. And yeah, it just happens that there will be casualties, collateral damage that we just can't prevent.
Yeah, and that certainly was the attitude. That collateral damage was certainly an attitude we've heard at some points in the discussions with Interpol. I think the things that are really the arguments that are really working with Interpol, and, you know, we're not there yet. We haven't achieved all of the things. You know, it's a good year's work to do before we get all the reforms that we think are needed. But the arguments that seem to work, not only with Interpol, but with the member countries' police forces around the globe, are that you can do things to weed out abusive cases without messing up the system. You know, it's possible to weed out these cases of abuse without throwing the whole thing into turmoil. And there's a real recognition in Interpol that, you know, it needs to focus on its core business. You know, and its core business is connecting the world's police and sharing information. But it was going through, in the past 10 years, it went through a kind of process of focusing on media profile, lots and lots of press releases and all sorts of things. There's a lot of focus on speed and quantity as a measure of success. So, you know, the annual reports of Interpol were all about number of red notices issued increases by X amount. You know, member countries can now circulate global information around the world without anybody even looking at it. You know, these were the kind of things that it was pushing for. And I think the membership of Interpol, or a number of member countries, are kind of saying, well, actually, you know, we'd much prefer you to do less, but to do it a bit better. We'd prefer to be able to trust the red notices that you circulate, because we have some trust that you have a reasonable system to weed them out. There's another kind of argument that works really well, I think, with Interpol, which is that if all the decisions about whether or not an alert is abusive, rest with the head of Interpol, the kind of executive head of the Interpol organisation, it puts them in an incredibly awkward position. So if it's always up to the Secretary General of Interpol to turn around to Russia and say, I'm sorry, we're not allowing the red notice for William Browder, then, you know, they get it in the neck from Russia. And so one of the things we're pushing for is a kind of rule of law model saying that you need to have an independent oversight mechanism that decides cases where there are complaints, that decides whether a system, whether an alert is valid or abusive. And I think that's appealing to the executive of Interpol, because I don't think they want to be held personally responsible for deciding to say no to their member countries. It's awkward. You know, Russia doesn't like it when the Interpol General Secretariat, the kind of executive body of Interpol, says no. So I think there are a number of different arguments, but it's been about constructing arguments which are reasonable, which don't undermine Interpol's effectiveness, but which also speak to the kinds of concerns that member countries have. And that seems to be working so far.
Mm-hmm. But it also touches upon an interesting issue of international collaboration on fighting crime.
Mm.
And this, not just the globalization of prevention or addressing crimes, but also how do you engage in these philosophical issues of defining criminality, of working on what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. In what way, if at all, your campaign touches on those, engages with those issues?
I think this campaign is part of a much broader issue around that, around the fact that it's absolutely right that countries have recognised they need to cooperate to fight crime. And, you know, the war on terror was the kind of pinnacle of that kind of movement, really, you know, a huge amount of cooperation to fight crime. And this campaign is really starting to say, yeah, but on what grounds? On what are the underlying principles of justice that need to be applied when countries work across borders to fight crime? And it throws up some really big, difficult issues. It throws up difficult issues because criminal justice at a domestic level is built within quite a robust, you know, varying degrees, but there are systems of accountability. You know, you have direct budget controls for police, you have parliamentary oversight, you have judicial oversight and judicial reviews. All those things are developed at a domestic level because they recognise that criminal justice has a huge impact on people's rights, that there's potential for abuse, and that safeguards are therefore needed. None of those things exist when countries operate across borders. This operates in a real kind of black hole legally. It's a bit like, for everyday crime, a kind of Guantanamo Bay of criminal justice, you know, designed to be unaccountable. And so it throws up some big issues, really, about how do you institute justice at a global level when countries are cooperating to fight crime. And I think it's good in that it demonstrates that actually it serves the purpose of fighting crime to put in place just mechanisms. You know, it's not, you know, fighting crime versus human rights and justice. In the kind of very real way, this campaign demonstrates that they're part and parcel of the same thing. That you're not going to be as effective at fighting crime if you don't have justice and safeguards and protection for human rights, because you get international policing systems which are stuffed full of abusive alert. So I think, you know, it's a campaign that touches on a much bigger and I think a really important issue that, you know, the human rights world and the human rights funding world hasn't really tackled. You know, it's typically people look at criminal justice at a domestic level. You know, we want to, you know, make fairer criminal justice systems. Let's, you know, throw money at new public defender services or local legislative reform. Clearly in some countries that doesn't stick. It's hard to get those kind of initiatives to have an impact. But it's also no longer the whole story. It's part of the story. And, you know, it might be difficult, impossible, perhaps, to create a fair criminal justice system within Azerbaijan, say. But surely we should at least be able to try and make sure that abuses of a criminal justice system in Azerbaijan aren't achieving a global reach and actually aren't being subsidised by the whole world. Like, I mean, the US government is Interpol's biggest funder. Does it really want to be funding an institution which is helping to globalise persecution by countries like Azerbaijan? I think not. I hope not. So, you know, there's some interesting kind of broader issues that this campaign really throws up.
On this wonderful note, I wonder if there are any questions. And then those on the phone, please jump in because we can't see you. Sarah?
How do you develop mechanisms that will be recognized by all the countries? I mean, presumably what we might recognize as not a crime is actually a crime in one of the member countries, you know, and speaking freely out against the government might be a crime in another country. How do you suggest Interpol really adjudicate that issue?
Interesting. There are two rules at the heart of Interpol's constitution that all its members have agreed to. So one is that it mustn't be involved in political cases. And the second is that it has to operate within the spirit of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so to tackle that kind of issue, a really interesting one, you have to look at what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the human rights norms protect. And so, for example, I mean, not only in terms of substantive criminal law, what acts are considered an offence, but also sentencing. You know, Interpol doesn't publish red notices where the potential sentence is death by stoning, for example, because it recognised that to do that would be contrary to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I don't know at the moment, they've not given us information at the moment, about how they apply those human rights protections in terms of substantive criminal law, in terms of saying no to certain types of criminal offence. I suspect that if a country were ever stupid enough to label criminal red notices, you know, they were involved in homosexual activity, that Interpol would probably say no. But practical reality is that countries don't do that. You know, they'll describe the offence as terrorism or paedophilia or, you know, they're pretty smart and they will come up with more kind of internationally appealing kind of labels. But I mean, another one of the successes we've had in the past 6 months is Interpol has now agreed to publish guidance for the first time on how it interprets this human rights protection. And I'm taking part in a working group with Interpol in early July, and that's one of the things I want to be raising about the kind of issues they need to look at in that context. There are issues around torture, you know, a universally kind of recognised, you know, human right. So how do or should they handle cases where the criminal prosecution is based on evidence obtained by torture? We have an interesting Algerian red notice case at the moment of somebody called Jamal Khatiti. It's a drug dealing case. But interestingly, in that case, the UN Committee Against Torture had specifically said he was arrested in Morocco when he first got out of Algeria, and an application was made to UNCAT, and they specifically said that Morocco must not extradite him to Algeria because the evidence against him had been obtained by torture, and because there was a very real risk of him being tortured when he is sent back. He was then arrested again in Spain on the same red notice, and again the Spanish court said, you know, we were able to get this UN decision before the court, and the court said no, we won't extradite. It's a big question. We did an application with the charity Redress to Interpol saying, surely when you've got a UN committee decision saying that you cannot extradite this person, that has to be grounds for removing the red notice, doesn't it? You know, this is, you know, a universally recognised right. So there are, you know, that's going to be a really interesting process to see how they tackle those issues around protecting human rights and how they interpret those rules.
I have a specific question is regarding accountability. So there's this case in Chile, a person who has a red notice on him. And in Chile, people have the right to access to information, so and habeas data. So every information about you or about the government has is basically yours. So he asked about which were the criteria to put a red notice on him and which were the basis and the grounds for this. And for me, it's interesting on how, so the response from the police in Chile was, this information is really not ours, it's from Interpol International, so we are not compelled to give that information to you, and we are accomplishing with the law and blah, blah, blah. So really how to balance these rights that people may have in their countries, for instance, the freedom of information rights, and how to balance that with like an international corpus such as Interpol International.
Yeah, really, really interesting. I don't know, I hadn't heard about this case. In practice, it's one of the big issues, the big problems for us is access to information. So, you know, we'll get somebody that comes to us and we'll do the due diligence and it looks like it's a really abusive case. And we'll do a big application to Interpol. Normally they don't bother replying, but you know, sometimes you get a reply. And sometimes they will say, we've gone back to the country that sought the red notice and they provided sufficient information to satisfy us in Interpol that it's an okay red notice, this one. And then you say, oh, right, would you give us at least an outline of what that information is so that we can have some chance of countering it? No. And, you know, I completely recognise that in the policing context, full disclosure of information is not going to happen. It's not possible. But an interesting issue came up in a series of EU cases, or the Cardi cases, I don't know if you've seen those, on the UN sanctions regime. And the same questions came up about, is it appropriate for the European Union to circulate information on these sanctions or to give legal power in Europe to these sanctions imposed from the UN? And the European Union Court said very clearly that there are certain basic principles of due process, that even international organisations, even when working in the context of fighting terrorism, need to comply with. And one of those is an outline of the information, at the very least to provide a brief outline or an explanation of the case against you, because otherwise, you know, you're boxing blindfolded. You have no idea who what you're battling. So, I mean, that's one of the big things we're pushing for in terms of Interpol's internal review mechanism, specifically on this issue of the approach being taken. Was it in Chile?
Yes, which is kind of weird because it's kind of a stable country. I mean, it's not one of these countries that will just prosecute someone, but. And I also like, because sometimes like access to information, you have some exceptions like national security or public security, but when it's information about yourself, then the law is really different. So that's...
Yeah, there's another, so access is actually another very pragmatic reason why countries are starting to care about this issue. So countries are starting, so the way Interpol works, you have Interpol, and then there are these different things called national central bureaus. They often call them Interpol Washington or Interpol, you know. And they aren't actually part of Interpol. They're domestic police forces, the bit of the domestic police force that works with Interpol. The interesting challenge for those NCBs, for those national limbs of kind of operating bits of the system, are that they are starting to become subject to legal actions. So in the UK, the UK NCB, the National Crime Agency, is facing a number of legal challenges at the moment on the basis of data protection, access to information about yourself, and basically saying that they have an obligation to make sure that information that they circulate, that they disclose certain stuff, but also that the information that they circulate is accurate, is true. And, you know, if you've got 120,000 of these things circulating across the globe, 10,000, 11,000 new ones issued a year, you can't really expect the NCB in every country to do that. Surely it's much better, practically, to get those checks done centrally so that the police in Washington or wherever, you know, that they know that, you know, that there's less chance that they will be subject to legal actions themselves. Canada is also being sued at the moment by a chap who spent a year in a jail in Lebanon as a result of an Algerian red notice, again about the fact that they refused to disclose any information to him. They stupidly sent him on a trade mission to Lebanon on behalf of a Canadian organised trip, despite having already shared information with Interpol about his whereabouts when asked by Algeria. And he was in prison for a year, and prison in Lebanon is not particularly nice. So, you know, there's a good practical litigation avoidance reason for Interpol to do a better job too.
Is Interpol not required to try to alert when a red flag goes out? It seems like most of these people aren't aware of it because they cross borders and countries, and before they know it, they're detained in a foreign country without any defense. Is that what? Are you looking at that, like perhaps requiring Interpol should be required to let that individual know or do everything they can to get in touch with that individual and say, you have a red flag against you, so at least they have the option of perhaps seeking legal advice or defense? Is that possible? Would that help?
It just would never happen. And the reason it would never happen, I mean, if you take a terrorism case, you know, a really serious, you know, proper terrorism case, you know, as one of the key tactics of police officers is taking people by surprise. Mm-hmm. You know, so they wouldn't want people to know that there was a red notice against them. They want to catch them by surprise. So a kind of institutional way of doing that, it wouldn't be possible. Some red notices go on the website. You know, when they're red notices that... you know, including some red notices where you really want to undermine someone's reputation, they go on the public website. So those people know they're there. One of our clients is Benny Wender, and he first learned about this red notice against him from Indonesia when he Googled his name, and he was sat there with his wife and five kids in his house, and he's like, wow, you know, I'm on Interpol's website with a red notice describing him as a wanted terrorist. You know, so some people, and you know what, it's not nice that, but perhaps it's better to actually see your name there than to be taken by surprise when you take a trip and, you know, change planes in the UAE or something. I don't know. I mean, but that has massive implications too, because your reputation's in ruins, you can't get a bank account, you lose your job. You know, many employers want to employ people who are on Interpol's website as wanted criminals.
You mentioned before briefly about the cases that Fair Trials takes and the process through which you identify which cases are the most strategic. But can you go into more detail about the vetting process that you go through, especially because I imagine, as you mentioned before, it's very complicated and there's a lot of people involved, so it takes a lot of due diligence, especially trying to avoid a case that would torpedo your reputation. So how do you navigate those somewhat choppy waters in terms of identifying cases?
Well, I mean, the approach we take is that we want to see reforms that help everybody. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously, you know, these due process safeguards should be available to everyone. Mm-hmm. But there is clearly a spectrum, and at one end of the spectrum you've got cases where it looks like it's a perfectly legitimate use of international criminal crime-fighting cooperation, the other end where it's clearly inappropriate, and then in the middle you've got lots of cases that are really difficult. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you do need a proper judicial fair process to kind of, you know, determine one from the other. We provide basic help to everyone that comes to us to help them try and navigate what system there is at all, and then we get actively involved in a small number of cases, and they are typically the cases of the people who can't afford lawyers. So, you know, there's the case of Bill Browder is really very well known, and, you know, it seems to me that is very clearly a case of a politically motivated red notice, and we've spoken to him about the issue a lot. But we didn't take on his case because, frankly, Bill can afford his own lawyers. You know, but the people that we do help, we can't afford lawyers. You don't get legal aid for challenging Interpol red notices in any country that we're aware of in the world. And, putting together an application is really hard because you need to understand the local political context. You need to understand, and it's really trying to get to the heart of why a person is being prosecuted. You know, what's really driving this prosecution? You know, that's difficult, and it requires a lot of intelligence from, you know, not only published human rights reports, but a lot of intelligence from local experts. It takes, you know, it's hard. And it means that the cases that hit, and then the other factor, you know, it means that the number of cases we can publicise is relatively limited. The other reason they're really limited is that for lots of these people, there are lots of people we help and we all do applications for, we never publicise their cases because it would put them in danger. You know, there are a number of Iranians in Scandinavia who we've been speaking, you know, if we start publicising names and countries of, you know, they're at risk. Similarly, with a number of Uzbek exiles in Europe. So, you know, there are a whole range of factors that determine which of the cases kind of end up in the press or in campaign films or in publications.
You had mentioned earlier briefly about having a sort of independent oversight mechanism over Interpol. I was wondering if you could just talk about that a little bit more and how you envision that, and if in this push to hold Interpol more accountable, you foresee any backlash from countries who would be opposed to this and how that might affect the functioning of Interpol.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that Interpol has two choices. It either loses its immunity from legal action, which seems to be the direction of a lot of travel of the international human rights courts, etc., you know, to question the legal immunity of international organisations where they have the power to violate human rights. So that Interpol has that choice. I would have thought not a particularly appealing option for Interpol, because it just doesn't know where the cases are going to get taken, it doesn't know what rules are going to apply. And what we're saying is your only other choice is to make sure that the mechanism that you have is a satisfactory one, which meets basic due process safeguards. And so, I mean, that's what we're looking at. They currently have something called the Commission for the Control of Interpol's Files, which is a kind of slightly odd name, and it's a slightly odd organisation. It kind of sits within Interpol. It has no legal power. It reviews complaints, but frankly, it seems to have big problems in terms of resources. There's very little by way of due process. You get no hearing, you get no disclosure of the information against you. You frequently don't get a response from them. You know, we've had cases where we've been sitting for 30 months waiting for a response from a red notice. You know, it's really broken. It does not work at all. And what we want them to do is to create a separate body, a quasi-judicial body, which deals purely with complaints. We think it needs to have the power to remove red notices. At the moment, this commission doesn't have that power. It has the power to make recommendations. And in practice, we think what happens is that it says to the executive of Interpol, we're minded to make a recommendation to remove this red notice. And the secretariat will say, we're minded to advise you to have a look again. You know, that kind of process goes on. If you don't have a binding legal power, that kind of process goes on. There's this one pretty famous case of Kazhigeldin, former Kazakh prime minister, who basically this commission looked at the process and said, no, this is clearly a political red notice. Interpol should delete it. But it didn't have the binding decision-making power. So what happened was the General Assembly of Interpol overturned that decision. Kazakhstan got a whole load of government of police forces to support it, and the red notice was reinstated. And, you know, it seems to me that if you have a set of rules, which include rules that ban political red notices, there's got to be a system which determines through a fair process whether those rules have been breached, and that actually has the power to enforce them. So, you know, we're not asking unreasonable amounts of stuff, and we're not actually trying to say to Interpol, this is exactly what it looks like, this is exactly how it should work, this is the time frames you should use. Because, you know, it's a policing organisation, and we want them to come up with what they believe is a workable process, but which meets these basic due process standards. I'm hoping that the next 12 months, with continued work by Fair Trials and Advocacy and getting other NGOs involved too, will result in those kinds of reforms. There certainly seems to be willingness and interest in it at the top of Interpol.
Is there anyone on the phone who would like to ask a question? Then I'm just wondering, what would be your vision for success of your campaign, and where would you like to go with it at the end of the campaign?
Interesting. So we have this report we produce has a set of recommendations, and it's a wonderful position to be in, to actually be able to go through that set of recommendations and to see a whole load of them having been ticked off in the past 6 months. Dealing with an organisation like Interpol, I have to say, I wasn't sure that it would, you know, it would work quite like that. So a whole load of the things we've asked for: refugee protection, prior review of red notices, published guidance on what it means by human rights, you know, these things, they're already happening. Really, what we need to see in the next 12 months is those changes having an impact in practice. More disclosure about how they're actually working, how they're reviewing these requests. And really crucially, what we need to see is a better review mechanism, a mechanism for redress. And that, I think, is really going to be the test of, you know, we'll have achieved some reforms that are really valuable, but I think that's kind of key to the whole thing, really, because it's that oversight process which really makes sure that these rules that are created are being enforced properly. So that's what success looks like. In terms of the next stage of the campaign, you know, we're a small organisation and we achieve an impact because we focus. And, you know, my temptation is to really focus in on finishing this campaign on Interpol. Having said that, there are clearly lots of overlaps with other issues. There are clearly lots of overlaps with issues around things like refusal of asylum because of politically motivated prosecutions. A whole load of regional policing cooperation mechanisms are being created at the moment. So Afripol is just about to be launched in the next year or so. You know, there's a lot of learning and relevant stuff that we can take from this Interpol to try and tackle more broadly this issue of instituting justice in a global justice context, you know. But for now, for the next few months, I really want us to focus on kind of finishing this work. And, you know, if it is a success, how great would it be to have, you know, Interpol as a beacon for kind of these other forms of cooperation globally, to say to other international organisations, you know what, we're a policing organisation and we can institute human rights safeguards that are workable for us. If Interpol can do it, you know, that says a lot. So hopefully it creates a bit of a kind of momentum around other international organisations that have an impact on human rights, looking at beefing up their human rights protection mechanisms.
On this note, I want to thank you for this conversation, and the report is available on your website, and so are the profiles of the publicly available people. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you.